Our second speaker, Dr. Stephen Hazler, is former deputy mayor of Greater London. He's been an active critic and opponent of the political left for over 20 years, and in the process was a founder of Britain's new party, the SDP. He was educated at the London School of Economics and is the author of numerous books on European politics, one of which, entitled The Death of British Democracy, foretold the slide to the extreme left of the Labour Party. This year, he's a visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation and a visiting professor at George Mason and Georgetown Universities. His forthcoming book is entitled Europe and America, The Crumbling Alliance. And as such, he's in an excellent position to comment on today's topic.
Well, Margot, Dick, members of the Philadelphia Society, can I first of all thank you for inviting me. I had prepared some high-blown prose to talk about the situation we find ourselves in at the moment before I get to my central theme. But I thought that Dick Allen's analysis of the foreign policy establishment and the media establishment virtually summed it up. It echoes what I've seen at home in Britain about the foreign policy establishment. It's often been said of the British Foreign Office and probably foreign establishments throughout the West, that a good definition for them is that they give away territory and positions when not absolutely necessary. They are masters of the preemptive cringe. To quote from a person in the audience who described Harold Wilson that way in a column. I also was reminded when Dick was talking about the media, for which he had particular personal experience, that things may not be that bad. There is a certain defensiveness in the air amongst liberals in the media. I was in a pub the other day in Washington, met someone for the first time who told me that he was about to engage in a course, teacher course, at a university in Washington entitled Journalistic Ethics. At which point I replied innocently, "Do they exist?" And his reply was very interesting. He says, "I'm bored with that answer." Bored, because it's coming more and more from ordinary people. I want to talk today about a specific area, the causes and what we can do about them, of the growth of nuclear pacifism. I'm going to concentrate on Europe, but many of the points I make are of direct relevance to the debate that is now beginning on the nuclear freeze here in the United States. Can I say at the outset that the outcome of the great European missile debate, which will be concluded one way or another during 1983, will determine much more than NATO's European nuclear posture for the 80s. At stake is whether nuclear pacifism will finally make a breakthrough from minority status to official, though undeclared, doctrine throughout much of Western Europe. The fact is that nuclear pacifism and the drive towards unilateral disarmament, which accompanies it, is now a settled aspect of European life. In short, those who believe that a few fancy footsteps, some marginal adjustments in nuclear posture or rhetoric will work in meeting this challenge are misreading the gravity of the situation. To attempt an explanation of this development is certainly not easy. Even so, such an attempt cannot begin, in my view, without recognizing the fear of nuclear war that is a feature of the European scene. for the sway that this powerful emotion has on so many Europeans and on some Americans is at the heart of the matter. A recent poll carried out in the International Herald Tribune has underlined the extent to which fear of war is a major factor causing pacifist and unilateralist sentiments. And they've also come out with the news that the better educated and professional classes seem to be more concerned about the threat of war and nuclear weapons than other groups. These fears among the educated are reinforced by a growing tendency within the various West European intellectual establishments to paint the United States as in some sense the cause of the present instability and by extension the primary threat to peace. Unilateralist and pacifist gurus, for instance Mr. E.P. Thompson, recently present at the National Press Club in Washington, also play remorselessly upon the fear of war. It is, after all, their primary card in the propaganda battle. And they have developed a new and powerful fear-inducing proposition. It is the concept of the target. Evidently, if one lives near a U.S. base which is to install cruise or Pershing II missiles, one becomes a target for Soviet first strike. This is the main propaganda weapon of the women who are present ringing the RAF USAF base at Greenham Common in England. Little does it matter that this idea directly contradicts other new unilateralist themes, such as the proposition that any nuclear exchange will cause general devastation, or the argument that only the West is committed to a first strike strategy, and so on. And the Soviet propaganda apparatus helps here too. It is my considered view that Western unilateralism and pacifism is based upon the fear of nuclear war, and the more intransigently, in a sense, that the Soviet Union behaves, the greater the fear will be. Consider, the Soviets know what they're doing. Consider statements by Georgi Arbatov, director of Moscow's Institute of USA and Canada Studies, who in a specific attempt to instill fear in the West European population compares the proposed Cruise and Pershing II deployments with the Soviet missile installations in Cuba in 1962. Also here, Soviet Defense Minister Ustinov stating, quote, Western European countries would suffer retaliation if the deployed weapons were put into operation by their master. As Vladimir Bukovsky has said, fear is a paralyzing and deranging force, so deranging as to lead some people to advocate the abolition of the police because the criminals are becoming too aggressive. But why have so many West Europeans suddenly become so fearful of war now? That is a question that intrigues me. The answer cannot possibly be the actual existence of nuclear weapons. We've been living with those for decades. Is the answer to be found in a new moral sensibility about the existence of nuclear weapons, one that was absent or stunted in the 50s and 60s? I doubt that too. Nor can the newly inordinate fear of nuclear war, in my view, be explained by anxiety over NATO nuclear strategy. For almost 30 years, NATO strategy has been based on the first use of nuclear weapons in the event of a Soviet attack upon Western Europe by conventional means. There has always been a rumbling discontent with this posture, but primarily because no one has been seriously prepared to advocate the necessary conventional arms build-up, which would render it redundant, this first-use declaratory posture, although not liked, has at least been widely tolerated and understood. Yet all of a sudden, so to speak, first use has become a great public issue. Soviet propaganda plays upon it. Eminent Americans, McGeorge Bundy, George Kennan, Robert McNamara, have recently proclaimed they wish us to renounce it, and voices in Europe are raised in agreement. If the doctrine of first use, which has served us well for over 30 years, was acceptable 10 years ago, why should it suddenly lose its previous validity? Battlefield nuclear weapons that they go on about, is that a new factor? We've been through this before. Battlefield and tactical nuclear weapons have been part of the situation for many years. Can we explain the new inordinate fear of war on heightened East-West tensions, either globally or in Europe? I don't think so. Ronald Reagan's rhetoric, I'd like to remind you, it's been pointed out before, is no stronger or no more robust than that used by John F. Kennedy when he was president, who spoke of opposing any foe, aiding any friend in the defense of liberty, who raised while he was running for candidate the question of the missile gap. Indeed, Kennedy's anti-communist phraseology, if used today by President Reagan, and it is sometimes, would call forth howls of protest across the West European continent. Yet Kennedy was a hero in most parts of Europe, and not only after his assassination. In general, as we look at the period ushered in by the Berlin airlift, running through the establishment of NATO, the points that Dick elaborated, the Korean War, the reign of Dulles, the Kennedy confrontation over Cuba, we've been living with heightened East-West tension for many years, arguably more tense then than now. So if these are not an explanation of the growth of nuclear pacifism, what is? The truth, in my view, is that the newfound objection, moral or otherwise, to the existence of nuclear weapons, the contortions over NATO nuclear strategy, the anxieties over East-West confrontational rhetoric, are all symptoms, not causes, of the fear of war. The new element in the picture, and the true cause of the fear, is to be found in an inchoate, often unspoken, but very real belief, in my view, that the superpower balance of might and will, which has kept the European peace for over 30 years, has, if not broken down, at least been severely weakened. The fact that the Soviet Union had become the preeminent conventional military power on the European continent was pretty clear following Yalta and Potsdam. Then we had the American build-up, the American re-entry into Western Europe, and the American nuclear monopoly. Then came the American defeat in Vietnam. That defeat reinforced those pessimistic elites in Western Europe who had all along claimed that the United States was an uncertain ally. I don't agree with that argument, and I want to come back to it very shortly towards the conclusion of my remarks. But if the defeat in Vietnam was the intellectual basis for the new geostrategic assessment by European elites, then other American and Western setbacks confirmed the thesis. The debacle in Iran, Jimmy Carter, say no more. Now, none of this is meant to suggest that the United States had in reality become an uncertain ally to the Europeans. In fact, exactly the opposite was and is the case. America, during its period of infirmity, maintained all its commitments to Western Europe, both in terms of declaratory policy and in defense expenditures and military presence. While the United States was grappling with the seemingly difficult and intractable problem of reconciling itself as a superpower to itself as a mass democracy, it was the Europeans who became the uncertain ally. Anti-American agitation in the streets of Western European capitals is nothing new, nor is the simplistic anti-Americanism of the European New Left. What is new is the overt anti-American animus from more respectable quarters which has accompanied this search for a separate West European identity. What we are seeing in Western Europe potentially, and I'm going to end on some good news, Merce, what we are seeing in Western Europe potentially is the accommodationist psychology and strategy. Indeed, accommodationist sentiment, not only as a harsh reality or as the lesser of two awkward choices, but as a preferred way of thinking, is very much the vogue. Accommodationism, or appeasement, is more insidious than overt neutralism. The accommodationist position is more subtle, more slippery, and when allied to the fear, to the cause of European détente, much more plausible. So the effect of these tendencies has not so much been to strengthen nuclear pacifism directly as to undermine the resistance to it. Because the United States has been seen as a weakening power, in will perhaps even more than in military might, the pro-American forces in Europe have also suffered a corresponding loss of confidence.
But if so, why has the attempt under President Reagan to restore both American power and American resolve frightened the Europeans instead of reassuring them? A very interesting question. One of the answers is that the change in the American position in the world, real or perceived since Reagan's election, should not be, in my view, exaggerated. There has been a welcome increase in U.S. defense expenditures. U.S. resistance to unbalanced arms agreements, either strategic or intermediate, is also a new and one hopes continuing aspect of resolve. On the other hand, there has not been, to put it bluntly, any clear-cut American victories, specific events which are widely seen to tilt the ground decisively in the U.S.'s direction. It is no part of my argument that the U.S. should seek such overt victories if this would endanger world peace. Even so, and this is the heart of the point I want to leave you with, any slow, aggregated American recovery that I believe is underway will take time to influence perceptions of the power balance. We are, in fact, and for as long as President Reagan's basic instincts continue to govern American global policy, only in the early stages of what may be seen as a change in the Soviet term, the correlation of forces. That is why the plan to deploy Pershing 2 and ground-launched cruise missiles on Western European soil is pivotally important. I said it at an earlier meeting, and I'll say it again. I think it could be the most important decision affecting the West and its relations with the Soviet Union since the Cuban Missile Crisis. There is a temptation on both sides of the Atlantic to engage in another tactical withdrawal even on this issue in order to placate the opposition and save what is left of the Western position in Europe. But to see the current missile dispute in this light, to think of the new development as a marginal or negotiable issue, deployment, is to display little understanding of the political and psychological dynamics involved in the contemporary European scene. After all, this deployment of Cruise and Pershings is the chosen political and propaganda battleground of the peace movement. It is the central plank of the Soviet peace offensive, which seeks to decouple Western Europe from the United States. It is also, thankfully, and as I said again the other day, fortuitously, the chosen political battleground of NATO itself. And could I just add one other point? I don't believe the Soviet Union is going to give the administration here or the West European governments any way of getting off this hook. I don't think the Soviets have an interest in any real arms control agreement in Western Europe. The Soviet interest is either to get a limited arms control agreement in the European theater which humiliates the West, or to have none at all and to try and whip up and support the protests and the civil disobedience that will follow. So, thankfully, I say, we are not going to have any alternative, because we're not going to get a proper arms control agreement, than to deploy these missiles. But after deployment, in my view, by restoring the actual balance of power in Europe, it will bring with it a greater sense of security and will therefore lessen the fear of war and simultaneously weaken the influence of neutralism, pacifism, and unilateralism. We may have to deal for a few months or a few years with some social instability. But after the balance has been restored, it is my argument, the central prop underlying the fear of war and nuclear pacifism will have been taken out from the other side. Now, could I finally conclude my remarks by saying a word or two, if it doesn't sound impertinent, about the role and direction of American conservatism, particularly with regards to Europe and other parts of the world as well, of course. I introduce the question of American conservatism and foreign policy not only because I'm speaking at the Philadelphia Society or because I've been associated through friendships over years with American conservatives, but because I believe its recent resurgence, and I believe there has been a resurgence, is pivotal, not only for America, but more broadly for the world. With Ronald Reagan in the White House, and with a potential new political consensus, it could be as far-reaching in its effects as Roosevelt's political coalition and intellectual resource bank of the 30s. It has often been argued by overly supercilious Europeans that when ideas died in Europe, they came to the US to be born again. This may indeed have been the case. Yet in the 1970s, it was in the United States and on the right that the intellectual counterattack upon the socialist secular religion, not only of the Soviet Union, but in the West, was most effectively formulated and expressed. But I have noticed one particular uncertainty in the conservative intellectual debate in the United States that I would like to very quickly address, because it has direct implications on what I've been saying about Europe. And it's directly relevant, too, to the struggle for the world. I've noticed that there runs through the conservative resurgence in the United States, and amongst other conservatives, a very definite ambivalence about America's role in the world. Is America a superpower or a very powerful traditional nation state? Is America to be a continent of freedom, isolated in a world of barbarism or neo-barbarism? Should America, to coin a phrase, develop a strategy of capitalism in one country? Should it retrench? Should it cease to defend those who find it difficult to defend themselves? Or even for a period seem willfully determined not to defend themselves? Should the United States cease to proselytize its values and its way of life in the face of anti-Americanism and the animus towards the free society that you see all over the world, including indifference and skepticism? Now, one can understand that these questions are raised on the right as well as the left in American politics. I am sure that the American conservative tradition and consensus is going to remain active, involved, and possessed above all, Dick Allen argued this, of a world view. Conservatism, I hope, cannot be inert and defensive. It has to continue the battle and to win the war. And so I do make a plea that in the debates on American foreign policy that conservatives have, the notion of projecting values and goals as well as power will remain. I know there's a problem at the moment because people look back to Woodrow Wilson and Thomas Jefferson and they look about the incompetent piety, over-piety of Jimmy Carter and human rights around the world. But in the struggle for the world, the struggle for the world of ideas, the cause of freedom, will win as long as the new American conservatism keeps a worldview and a sense of the future. I, for one, wish it well. In a sense, we are like Longfellow, all hanging breathless on thy fate.
Well done, Stephen. Well said.